This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and thank you for joining us on our Main Street across the state of North Dakota this time of day. You know, once a month, we check in with Jack Russell Weinstein, the host of Why, Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life, to find out what's going to be on his program, which is broadcast on the Prairie Public Network, 5 p.m. Central, on Sunday. And Jack joins us from our studio in Grand Forks. We're going to talk about what is Sharia law this week, Jack.
That's right. It was a super exciting topic because I know very little about it. And I think, like most listeners, I just know what I hear on the news and what politicians complain about and what people's fears describe. But what it really is, that was a whole new thing for me.
This is the law around the religion Islam. And who's your expert that you're going to chat with this time?
Well, his name is Professor Robert Gleave, and he's from Exeter, England. So we had a long distance call, if we can even call them that anymore. And he runs a whole bunch of different projects having to do with Islam, everything from just textual analysis to water management under Islamic law. So he really has his finger on the pulse.
Well, let's define the term Sharia. It's an Arabic word, I take it.
It does. It means the path. And what it just refers to is the message that God has given humanity and how to follow that message. So when we say Sharia law, Rob told me, we're actually being redundant. It's like saying pin number or pizza pie. Sharia does mean law. It does mean the path. And so Sharia law is just saying like the law. And what it refers to is not just the Quran and not just the individual beliefs, but the way that folks have interpreted it and engaged in it and religious precepts of how to act as a person, how to act as a neighbor, and of course, how to act as a citizen. So it's law in the largest sense of the term.
Well, we have this cultural barrier that has been exacerbated by terrorism and sort of these nations with which we're at odds that follow Islamic law. Is this religion unlike any other religion in terms of blind faith, or does it share sort of those variations that we have in every religion?
I think all religions are pretty much exactly the same. I mean, not in terms of what they believe, but in how they're structured. I always tell my students, there's no such thing as Judaism, there's no such thing as Christianity, and there's no such thing as Islam. There's Judaisms, there's Christianities, and there's Islams. And so what makes the difference between the denominations is how they interpret the text. So some people are going to interpret fairly liberal, some people are going to interpret fairly conservative, and the people who interpret it that way feel very strongly about what their meaning is. And so Islam has stuff that isn't wonderful and stuff that is beautiful and inspiring, stuff that is not pacifist and stuff that is redemptive and forgiving, like every religion. And so what Sharia law does is help give us a sense of not just what the interpretation is. See, I said Sharia law again. What Sharia does is not just give us the interpretation, but the rules for interpretation. What counts as a good piece of evidence? What counts as a good reason? And what counts ultimately as Muslim in the first place?
And occasionally I have to remind myself that these are traditions, these religious traditions, Jewish or Christian or Muslim, are Abrahamic. I mean, they have a common sort of thread through them, don't they?
Oh, they absolutely are. And I always refer to them as exactly that, the Abrahamic religions, because they all see themselves as connected to Abraham in the Hebrew scriptures. Judaism came first. Christianity comes along as a derivation of Judaism, and Islam comes along after that. Islam starts about 1,500 years ago when, as the story is told, Muhammad has a revelation. The angel Gabriel gives God's message directly to Muhammad, and then Muhammad wants to present that to human beings. Some people believed him, some people didn't. But this was the start of a religion. And what's interesting about Islam is that in addition to the text, the Quran that he dictates or that he, writes down based on the angel's dictation, Muhammad is also perceived as a perfect person insofar as any human being can be perfect. So they don't just look at the text. They look at what Muhammad chose to do. The prophet is a model person to to choose to make decisions based on. So because the prophet Muhammad didn't drink, Muslims don't drink. Because the Prophet Muhammad was kind in some ways, people will be kind in those same ways. And so the religion starts just like any other religion, with traditions and revelations and stories, mythologies if you prefer, and then this entire discussion, worldwide 1500-year discussion develops.
So you got the prophet, whether it's Moses or Abraham or Jesus or Muhammad, having this sort of divine experience and a personal relationship with a deity. And as a result of that, that person, Moses or Jesus or Muhammad or Abraham, is in a sense divine himself.
What that means varies from religion to religion. So for example, in Christianity, Jesus is literally divine, right? He's interpreted as a deity in himself, the Son of God, the Holy Ghost, depending on which denomination you are. Moses in Judaism is not divine at all. He's one of the few people that actually gets to talk with God. The Hebrew scriptures actually suggest that he sees God's physical body. He sees God's backside, actually. and Muhammad isn't divine either in that sense. But Muhammad, unlike Jesus and Moses, plays a special part because Muslims aren't allowed to depict Muhammad in any imagery. He's so perfect and he's so wonderful that they're not allowed to draw pictures. This didn't come up in the conversation, but there's a very famous movie called The Message. I think it's like 8 hours long, that tells the story of Muhammad, but he is portrayed by a talking camel, interestingly enough. And this is because they don't want to show Muhammad. So they use a symbol to sort of hold its place. And no one would ever mistake the camel for Muhammad. So I think they chose the camel in part because no one is going to think, hey, this is Muhammad. They're going to think, oh, look, there's a talking camel. I guess that's supposed to take the place of Muhammad. So what it means to be divine changes. What's most relevant, of course, is the message and how we use these people as role models.
Well, that gets to what is the literal word of God, and does that make translation possible?
That's right. That's actually the question that I started the discussion with, because when Gabriel gives Muhammad the message, he gives it to him in Arabic, right? And so the word, the literal word in Arabic in Islam is sacred in a very special way, much more so than in Christianity, but similar in some ways to Judaism. So that means if you have an Arabic word and you translate it into English, is it still sacred? Is it exactly the same? It's not. So there is a huge debate in Islam as to whether or not you can, quote, translate the Quran, whether the English language, German, Italian, Spanish, Chinese version of the Quran that people have in their hand, is that really the Quran? And for traditionalists, it's not, because it's not in Arabic.
Nevertheless, Muhammad had his divine inspiration hundreds of years ago. Languages evolve just like cultures do. So isn't Sharia, like the Judeo-Christian tradition, a law that is relied on translation and interpretation over generations?
Oh, absolutely. Let me use a silly example. When I first went to Austria to live many years ago in my youth, I would say, hi, I'm Jack, or I'd say Jack, and people would know I was an English speaker instantly, and I couldn't figure out why. But it turns out that they don't say Jack Weinstein like Americans. They say Jack Weinstein. And so when people say Jack, hello, Jack, is that my name? Or is that a stand-in for my name? I don't think of myself as Jack. I think of myself as Jack. That's a very simple thing. But then words mean different things. I once told somebody that I loved my computer. And in German, that meant something a little different. And they thought it was very weird, you know? And so take that and then take questions like, well, now we have modern transportation. Now we have the internet. Now we have nation states. When Muhammad lived more than 1,500 years ago, the nature of community was different. The nature of international politics was different. The nature of economics was different. Technology was different. So you have to develop all these laws and these interpretations to determine what to do. One other example is – Rob and I were talking in the show, the Quran prohibits drinking wine. wine from grapes. It doesn't say anything about vodka. It doesn't say anything about scotch. So the jurists, the interpreters, the lawyers had to determine, was wine the only drink that was forbidden, or was alcohol completely forbidden? And it turns out, interestingly enough, that the Quran gives reasons for this. And the reason for forbidding wine is it's an intoxicating beverage. You're not supposed to drink it because it's intoxicating. And so the interpreters over 1500 years decided, well, that will apply to other intoxicating beverages. So literally, scotch is not prohibited, but in actuality, it is.
Okay, but this still gets us to a point where these texts are sort of shaped by a telephone game over generations and the changing cultures of the interpreters.
Oh, that's absolutely right. And that's one of the reasons why there are so many denominations, right? I've known many Muslims in my life. Some of them were the most humble, generous, loving human beings I've ever met and used their religion to explain some of the things they did. And I've met, like every other religion, some not so nice, some arrogant, some self-involved, sometimes even some mean Muslims. And if you ask them, they would offer an interpretation too. This telephone game that you're calling it, it's not that people aren't communicating well. It's that people have different understandings of how the world works and how the religion is supposed to be understood and what an individual phrase or paragraph or verse means. And then they talk about it with each other. This is what's so important. You know, you get a lot of people who will say, oh, I read the Quran and here's a violent point, just like you get people who read the Gospels and they say, oh, I read this passage, this verse, and it doesn't make any sense. You can't read something on its own. You have to read it in context with everything, and you have to read the people who've been reading it and talk to the people who've been talking about it. And so it's not just that there are these different interpretations, but that the people with different beliefs are engaged with each other to try to figure out common ground when they can and changing their minds when they must.
Well, let me pose a paradox to the philosopher.
Uh-oh.
Language helps communicate an idea. It also may distort that idea.
We call that the study of hermeneutics. It's a
Thank
big
you.
Word. It actually didn't come up in the discussion, although Rob writes about it quite a bit. It made popular by a German philosopher named Gadamer. Hermeneutics is the study of interpretation. And the problem is that it's not only that I as a reader don't necessarily understand what the text says, but I as a writer might not even know exactly what I'm writing down. You've had this experience, Doug, where you've said something and it came out wrong, or where you've written a note to someone and or an email or a text and you think you said this one thing, but it turns out that you actually said something different.
Yes.
And so there's this thing called the hermeneutic circle, which is the writer doesn't really understand what the writer's doing. The reader doesn't understand what the reader's doing. And then when the writer talks to the reader, there's miscommunication. So it just goes in a circle because you can't really know what a text actually says ever. There are some people who would suggest we can't even really accurately communicate. So if people are interested, that's called hermeneutics, H-E-R-M-E-N-E-U-T-I-C-S. I had to think about that. And it's an incredibly rich area of study. And all religion of every kind is steeped in the hermeneutic problems.
Well, one of the reasons you're talking about this issue, what is Sharia, is because in our modern world, terrorists, militants have used Islam as sort of an identity.
This is right. And I asked Rob about this in the show, and he said, I asked him, for example, what the word jihad actually means, and it means struggle. And it can be a spiritual struggle, it can be a political struggle, it can be a personal struggle. And Rob says that first, Islam is not a pacifist religion. Of course, neither is Judaism. And depending on in your interpretation of Christianity, it isn't either. But also there is massive debate among scholars as to whether or not ISIS, the Islamic State, is Muslim in the first place. There are people who say that it is. There are people who say that it isn't. The fact that The Islamic State says they're Muslim doesn't necessarily mean anything. We all know people who claim to be Christian who do things that we think are not Christian. And we all know people who claim to be Jewish and the same thing. And so there's a huge debate as to whether or not the terrorists can even fairly call themselves Muslim. The two sides of the discussion, though, are interesting. You can claim that they aren't, and that helps protect the religion. But if you claim that they are, then you have a common vocabulary to talk to them and maybe try to moderate them. If you push away the religious aspect, you can't use the redemptive, peaceful, loving aspects of Islam to get them to see that other people are important too. And so it seems like a silly scholarly debate. Are the terrorists really Muslim? But it's really about how in the long term we can fix the world and how we can take fanatics, for lack of a better term, and moderate them to bring them back into the human community, stopping the violence, stopping the hatred, and making everyone much better off.
Well, we also hear about these draconian punishments that have been imposed by these terrorists when they've taken over places in the Middle East, for example. And it strikes me, you know, if you're talking about stoning somebody to death, which has actually been done, these so-called Sharia punishments strike me as similar to Old Testament punishments.
There's certainly a key moment in the Gospels where Jesus suggests that we not stone people anymore, let those without sin cast the first stone. But we also know that the history of Christianity is one of brutal punishment, including just the Crusades. Yes. Judaism and the same thing, right? There's this brutality. These things do exist in Sharia. However, they exist in very specific circumstances under very specific conditions. So it isn't, you know, the famous example of cutting off a thief's hand. It isn't just willy-nilly that you cut off a thief's hand. You have to meet certain requirements. And I'm not a scholar, so I don't know what that is. The problem is that if we judge Sharia by the handful of things that we think are brutal, then we're ignoring the 1,500 years and the tens of thousands of pages that aren't brutal. I mean, I certainly wouldn't want my religion judged by one or two horrible things, right? There's a story in the Hebrew Scriptures where one family gets another family drunk, and then while they're drunk, circumcises them, right?
Oh, wow.
I do not want Judaism judged by that. I do not think any Jew alive thinks that we can justify mass drunken circumcisions, right? So it's part of this is about the generosity of the non-Muslim. Part of this is about asking, when you read someone else's religious text, are you going to read it with an eye towards criticism and skepticism and I'm going to find the stuff that's bad? Or are you going to read it with an attempt to understand the beauty and the passion and what is it about the religion that attracts people to it? And I certainly hope that people look at my religion that way. I try very hard to look at other religions that way. And I think that part of the point of the discussion is not to, you know, preach and say to the audience, you should stop being afraid of Sharia or you should stop disliking these people, but rather say, hey, look, here is this incredibly beautiful tradition. It's inspired millions and millions of people for 1,500 years. There's got to be some good stuff about it. Let's look at that. Let's give it the benefit of the doubt and figure out what we learn about Sharia, about Islam, about our own religions, and about ourselves.
Well, okay. People can do that by tuning in to Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life at 5 o'clock Central Time on Sunday. And, of course, your shows are always available in the archives at whyradioshow.org. And this discussion you have went longer than an hour, that's for sure, with Robert
yes.
Gleave. So, Jack Russell Weinstein, thanks as usual.
Thank you, Doug. It's always a pleasure.
Coming up next, part three of our series on tariffs from Harvest Public Media.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Radisson Hotel in downtown Fargo, featuring a Valentine's package February 14th through the 16th that includes a guest room, four-course dinner for two, and wine or a sparkling cider delivered to your room. 701-232-7363 or RadissonFargo.com.
Hey, this is Bill Thomas at Prairie Public, and thanks and congratulations, too, to everybody who joined up or renewed the short and sweet membership drive. Delicious cocoa truffles going out all over the place, and it's wonderful. If you haven't joined already, well, you can. You can call 800-359-4145 or go to prairiepublic.org up till February 8th. That's the deadline. So if you still want to get in on it, you can. Let's hear from you, and thanks to everybody who helped.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Piles of soybeans dot the horizon in parts of the Midwest. Visual reminders that the trade war between the U.S. and China means exports of the crop are down. But as Harvest Public Media's Jonathan Ohl reports, the effects of the tariffs aren't felt equally among soybean producers.
Sometimes you need a guide to understand the complicated economics of agriculture, even more so when it intersects with global trade issues. Pat Westhoff studies and teaches the economics of agriculture at the University of Missouri. He says, in theory, since everyone in the ag sector is facing the same lower demand and lower prices in the soybean market, it should affect them all the same. But in reality, that's not the case.
Or even though the impact on prices, the impact on total revenues may be very similar across scale of production, sometimes the effect on net revenues can be very different. So a given price that may be very difficult for a large producer, can be catastrophic for a smaller producer.
Or in other words, if you're a small farmer, you're probably in trouble. Large agribusinesses have worldwide sources and markets. Even medium-sized farmers in the U.S. are diversified as well. Robert Alpers is one of those medium-sized producers in central Missouri. Right now, he's tending the newborn calves. His 550-head cattle operation and a side business of making and fixing farm necessities, like feeding troughs and livestock gates, gives his family farm multiple sources of income. He also farms 4,000 acres, about half of its soybeans and the other half corn. Alper says despite the tariffs, he's hanging in there.
Our family's fortunate enough. We've got about, over 300,000 bushel of storage. So we're able to hold our crop for a better price, and we've got livestock, and the corn market has moved up a little bit, so we have been moving some corn on the cash market.
That diversification, along with the tariff bailout payments from the U.S. Department of Agriculture, have left Alpers in a position where he says he's doing okay. But Alpers says most of his friends and neighbors aren't as lucky. Without other sources of income or storage, they're going to have to make some difficult decisions in the coming year.
Maybe using a cheaper seed that you really don't want to, and start making cuts that may affect your bottom line the next year. And then it just kind of keeps snowballing.
Alper says farmers don't suddenly go bankrupt. They start cutting, borrowing more, and eventually get in over their heads. And he says the low prices and lack of market access due to the tariffs are the kind of thing that can get that ball rolling for small farmers. Even with his storage, cattle business, and corn crop, Alper says another year of tariffs, if that's what happens, will force him to make some tough decisions, although he's confident his family will continue farming. Large agriculture companies that buy, sell, and process soybeans are faring the best during the trade war. Cargill, Archer Daniels Midland, Bayer, and even the trade group that represents the industry declined requests to comment for this story. But Cargill CEO David McLennan did speak with Yahoo Finance in late January.
Exposure means that we've had to shift supply chains from North America to South America. So as of several months ago, China stopped buying what at the time out of the U.S. was 30 million metric tons of soybeans. But it means that more soybeans have come out of Brazil and Argentina.
Westhoff, the ag economist, says what that means is that multinational companies like Cargill get their soybeans from lots of places, including countries that are not in a trade war with China.
So sometimes they may have a loss on the U.S. operation they had not been anticipating, but they might be able to make at least part of that up by increased sales of South American products, since South American soybeans are going to be capturing a premium in the Chinese market from what they would have had had it not been for the tariffs.
Large agribusiness companies are lobbying the Trump administration for an end to the trade war so U.S. soybeans can fully return to the Chinese market. Cargill's McLennan specifically said it's in his company's best interests to protect North American farmers. But how long anyone in the soybean business will be able to last, or how healthy it will be if and when the tariffs are lifted, could depend on how big they are. Jonathan Ohl, Harvest Public Media.
That was the last in Harvest Public Media's three-part series exploring the nearly year-long trade war between the U.S. and China. To read more about it, go to harvestpublicmedia.org. Coming up on Main Street, our Friday discussion with News Director Dave Thompson about the stories in the news this week, and Matt Olin reviews a new movie about Vincent van Gogh at Eternity's Gate. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The North Dakota House Education Committee is recommending the full House kill the bill, which would create two separate boards of higher education, one for the two research universities and the other governing the rest of the system. As introduced, it would have been a three-board system, one for UND, one for NDSU, and one for the other nine institutions. It was amended in committee, then the committee voted for a do-not-pass. The committee chairman, Grand Forks Republican Representative Mark Owen, says the bill may have been premature because there has to be a change in the state's constitution. That resolution was still being drafted when the committee took its action.
Prudence suggests that maybe, perhaps, you get a concurrent resolution on the ballot first and you make sure the people vote for it. Because keep in mind, if the people vote for it November 2020, it'll go into effect 1 December. Of 2020. And then in 21, the legislature meets, and then they can take this up.
Owen says committee members had some problems with some of the proposed changes on who can be a member of one of the boards. He says there's been talk of making changes to the existing board, expanding its membership, and going to longer terms. The main sponsor of the bill, Fargo Republican Representative Shannon Roars Jones, was having the language for a constitutional amendment drafted. She says she doesn't know what the strategy will be going forward. No one was hurt when a BNSF railway train hit a car that was struck in the snow at a railroad crossing near Page, North Dakota. The North Dakota Highway Patrol says three people who had been in the car were trying to push the vehicle out of the way when the train approached at around 3:15 a.m. on Friday. The crash happened about a half mile south of Page on State Highway 38. The crew applied the emergency brakes on the train, which catapulted the car into the right-of-way. The railroad crossing remained blocked for several hours while the investigation was conducted. Captain Brian Newind says charges against the driver are not expected. And a shortage of lawyers in North Dakota could be hindering people's access to justice. Job Service North Dakota says attorney job listings have increased 300% in the past year. State Bar Association Director Tony Weiler says the problem looms large in rural parts of the state, where some towns may have one attorney or none at all. He says the issue is compounded by the fact that many in practice are nearing retirement age.
We know that in our rural communities or smaller communities that there are lawyers who have been practicing there for years. They're either ready to retire or they have retired, and we're not filling those positions with new lawyers or younger lawyers.
Legal Services of North Dakota Executive Director Richard LeMay says the lack of attorneys presents a big challenge to providing legal aid for civil cases. Already, legal service organizations like his face a funding crunch. And when they don't have the capacity to help, it's usually low-income folks and seniors who suffer. LeMay says there are a few options for people who don't have access to an attorney.
It's a big problem. And so what that means for people, they either get adept at using the phone or they travel hundreds of miles to get services. We have seniors who their whole life they've dealt with any issue they have face-to-face.
Weiler points to the Rural Justice Program, a partnership between his organization and the University of North Dakota Law School, as one promising avenue for attracting more lawyers to sparsely populated communities. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Well, it's time to talk to our news director, Dave Thompson, who joins us every Friday from our studio in Bismarck to look over the week's big stories. Dave, before we do that, we should be thanking people for our short and sweet membership drive, which still has a moment left.
That's right. This is the last day. If you want to get in and send a box of those cocoa truffles to a friend or to a loved one, now is the time to do that.
And it's easy to do, 800-359-4145.
You can also text at 484848 if you want. Text the word support, and you can get a link to send some boxes.
Or go online to prairiepublic.org and click on donate.
Absolutely.
It's very easy for those of you who have done it. Thank you very much.
Yes.
Dave, let's start with the Senate killing the bill to raise the gas tax by a modest amount, actually.
A modest amount, only 4 cents per gallon, and this is all he's talking about, from going from 23 to 27 cents. There doesn't seem to be a lot of appetite to raise the gas tax, but I don't think we've seen the last of the proposals, because when it comes down to the March revenue forecast, I'm thinking that there might be some effort to maybe add some gas tax too, and that's to match federal highway dollars to get that done.
And of course, 4 cents multiplied many times means $59 million every biennium.
Right,
it's a lot of cash. Let's talk about the credit North Dakota XL customers are going to get on their bills.
This has been a long time coming because, remember, it goes back to the Tax Cut and Jobs Act that passed at the end of 2017. And in 2018, the Public Service Commission said, we want to find out how the utilities are going to handle the money they're going to save by the reduction in taxes. Well, Xcel had proposed, yes, a one-time bill credit of $46, but they had proposed that they would keep the money that they would collect in tax years 2018 and 2019, which come due in 2019 and 2020, and use that to hold off on a rate increase. And that went back and forth for the Public Service Commission for about a year, and they finally decided, yeah, this is a good deal because, you know, the utility is saying it's been making so many upgrades, it's really not making a lot of money. And they're saying that we'll use this to head off any rate increase and we won't file anything till the end of 2020.
Well, that's a pretty good deal for XL customers because they get that credit and plus they get their rates held stable for a couple of years.
Exactly, and that was the argument that finally won over the day for all three commissioners.
Let's talk about this Emmons Logan Wind Farm that's been approved by the PSC. You reported about that yesterday.
Sure did. An interesting wind farm. You know, they were using 28,000 acres of land in Emmons and Logan County. Now, there seems to be a lot of excitement in that region because, you know, it's very much an agriculture region. And with commodity prices being low, there are some people who are saying, well, you know, this is one way for farmers to make some money because, you know, they'll rent out the land where the turbines are placed. And this is going to help Main Street as well. So there was a lot of support in the community for that.
Okay, now let's get into the number of boards we should have for higher education.
Yes, have some new information on that,
please
too.
Please share it, yeah.
The committee, the House Education Committee, voted to amend it to 2 boards from 3 boards. And I'll go into that. The 3-board was a separate board for UND, separate board for NDSU, and then a separate board for the rest of them. A bunch of legislators went to the governor and said we would support a 2-board plan, and that would be one for the research universities, one for everybody else. It came to a committee. The committee amended the bill to do it and then has recommended do not pass.
Wow.
And the reason why, and I talking to the chairman of that committee, Representative Mark Owens of Grand Forks, he said one of the reasons they did that is because there's supposed to be a constitutional amendment forthcoming too, because changing the Board of Higher Education takes a constitutional amendment. And he was claiming that what you need to do is have that amendment drafted first. Then we could take a look at implementation legislation. And if it goes on the ballot, it'll be on the ballot in November 2020. Legislature's meeting in 2021. They can work on getting the implementation legislation. And there was some concerns by some of the committee members because as rewritten, you don't have to be a resident of the state of North Dakota to be on that board. You could be appointed from out of state. You don't have to have a connection to any of the universities. And they said that made some of the committee members uncomfortable.
Well, it's interesting. This is sort of a procedural process now then.
Pretty much. Yeah. And we have not heard the end of this.
Okay.
We have not heard the end of this.
Well, they certainly heard a lot about up to now.
Okay.
How about this bill that would provide $45 million over 2 years for research at the 2 research universities?
And I think you remember when the 2 university presidents from NDSU and UND were traveling the state saying, we're proposing $100 million for 2 years, $25 million per year per university for research. And they put pen to paper in Senate appropriations and decided they could do $45 million. So it's a vehicle. And again, it goes back to this March revenue forecast. And I hate to keep bringing this up, but you know that's going to drive a lot of things to find out where the state's at and whether the state can afford some of these things that – but they think $45 million for research is a good modest start.
And that would come from the legacy fund.
It would. And that would come from the proceeds of the legacy fund.
Sure. Which is okay. Well, how about – this one is kind of a conundrum to me. The Energy Research Center is proposed for the Energy and Environmental Research Center.
That's right. This energy plan is – if you think about earmarks for front-end research, taking a new idea and getting started on it – a lot of those earmarks came from Congress. Well, Congress right now is not doing earmarks, and this was seen as a replacement for some of those earmarks. You know, they could put $6 million into a new idea, and EERC can start working on the new idea.
Well, as I was reading your story, it occurred to me that part of this might be a sort of a preemptive idea because climate change, global warming is getting some real purchase now as an issue.
The
EERC is, of course, one place they can talk about carbon sequestering, the kinds of research they need to do to make carbon more palatable.
Right, and the idea of the Project Tundra to try to eliminate as many of the emissions from coal-fired power plants as possible to keep coal as a viable alternative. And then there's some idea that maybe some of this research can crossbreed with agriculture research. So there's some of that too.
That'd be interesting. You had a story this week that the tribal taxation bill is working its way through the legislature. This has been long in the works
It's been long in the works, and what you have is a really good deal for both the state and for the tribes, and that is terms of – it used to be just a 50-50 split on oil taxes, but now on certain lands it's 80-20 for the tribes, and on certain lands it's 80-20 for the state. Now, everybody thinks this is a win-win and that it could mean that we could attract more oil industry here because of the competition with the Permian Basin and the others, that you have a really solid – tax plan that everybody knows has some certainty to it. That word was brought up a lot at that press conference, was certainty.
Well, the three affiliated tribes have benefited from oil production.
They certainly have.
This one struck me as an interesting story. There's a bill to prohibit labeling certain products as beef or meat pending in the state legislature.
You know, I had not heard about this research that's going on to take, some part of an animal and kind of grow something in a petri dish to become a product that's edible.
We'd had a guy on Main Street months ago talking about this, and it was right out of science fiction to me.
Right, but apparently there is some real move toward this, and the state of North Dakota is taking a look at preemptive legislation so it doesn't be labeled as beef, because they're worried about what this might do to the beef industry in North Dakota.
Well, the result is supposed to be essentially a cultured cell protein product, which is what they want to call it, but it would replicate beef.
It would. And that's when I had not heard that term before, and I apologize for not hearing the interview. I must have been doing something else.
Oh, I imagine you found something else to do.
I think I had, yeah.
How about this cottage food producers defending practices? This has been an issue in our state with people
right.
who just sell food at farmers markets and things
right.
like that.
Right, and there's been some rules proposed by the state health department that the cottage industry does not like. Cottage industry has come back with its own rules that the health department says, well, maybe that's too lax. And now they want the legislature to get involved to have some kind of – again, the word for the day being certainty on some of these things.
But North Dakota is pretty lenient on this right now.
Pretty much. You're talking about pies that are sold at church fairs or at, street fairs, things like that.
Okay. Well, let's finish with a committee mulling a bill to require candidates for local office to declare party affiliation. Are we not partisan enough?
that's the worry, because if you look at the story and further on down the story, I was quoting Jim Casper, state representative from Fargo, who said the United Republican Committee in Fargo actually has gone into the business of endorsing candidates. It's not on the ballot as Republican Democrat, but they are issuing endorsements.
Okay, so maybe this will be required ultimately.
I know there's a lot of pushback from cities and counties.
Well, while we're talking about parties and affiliation in the legislature, as we often do, who's your guest for the legislative review tonight?
Well, my guest is the chairman of Senate Appropriations, Senator Ray Holmberg from Grand Forks. Got a lot to talk about in terms of budget, because there's a lot of big proposals out there.
Well, of course, taxation, revenue, that's pretty important. You keep mentioning this March deadline too.
Yeah. Early March will be this new revenue forecast from the consulting firms that do the forecasting of the state of North Dakota. And normally this March forecast is what drives real spending decisions.
All right. So the legislative review with Dave Thompson and tonight Ray Holmberg, 6:30 Central on Prairie Public. Always a pleasure to talk with you, Dave.
Thank you.
Coming up this week on the Thomas Jefferson Hour, we speak to Clay Jenkinson about his recent cultural tour.
People come from the Jefferson Hour from all over the country, even all over the world, to these cultural tours on the Lewis and Clark Trail. These are at Locksaw Lodge, west of Missoula. One was on Shakespeare, the other was on the great 21st century issue of Water and the West, and we have the sort of conversation that everyone wants to have. And when I walked into the barn today, you said, tell us about those cultural tours.
We also talk about Jefferson and some of the unique characteristics that we all seem to see.
And the philosophy of the Thomas Jefferson Hour.
So join us for all that and more on this week's Thomas Jefferson Hour.
Sunday at 11 Central, 10 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
It's time to go to the movies with Matt Olean, and today we're going to talk about a new movie that the trailer I've seen, it's very intriguing historically, and frankly, it looks like a very interesting portrayal, At Eternity's Gate with Willem Dafoe.
Willem Dafoe is Vincent van Gogh. Now, van Gogh died when he was 37, so clearly Willem Dafoe is far too old to play this part, but somehow he kind of pulls it off. Few actors can express with their eyes and their emotions kind of what they're feeling like Dafoe can. And this is his fourth Oscar nomination now. And he really conveys the tortured artist well.
There's a very evocative self-portrait of Vincent van Gogh.
Yes.
And frankly, in the trailer, when you see Willem Dafoe with this thing around his ear, it looks like him.
It does. And Kirk Douglas looked like him as well in Lust for Life, the other really famous biopic, which came out in 1956. This is a much different film, though, than that. Julian Schnabel, the director, who's famous for The Diving Bell and The Butterfly back in 2007. He also directed Before Night Falls and Basquiat. It's almost an experimental approach to the subject matter. It covers a very small portion of Van Gogh's life where he's painting with Gauguin, and then when he ends up in the insane asylum after Gauguin leaves and he cuts his ear off. It talks about his struggles forming relationships with women, and the townspeople don't like him and the kids don't like him. And so it's a very small part of his life. And the way Schnabel films it, it's very experimental. It's not a linear, typical narrative structure that you're used to from Lust for Life, the Kirk Douglas picture with Anthony Quinn as Gauguin, opposite Douglas as Van Gogh. So that's going to, I think, confuse some mainstream audiences, but you need to stick with it and understand it's really a portrait of Van Gogh, the tortured artist. We also get great speeches by Dafoe about why he paints the way he paints. He paints very rapidly, very fast, and that's his style. And of course, he can't sell paintings, and Gauguin clashes with him about how to paint, and his style isn't working and this kind of stuff. But I think what Dafoe and Schnabel correctly get through to the audience is this is what made Van Gogh great, even though no one knew it at the time. There's a great, great quote that he has in the movie, whether he said it or not, where he says, maybe I'm painting for people that have not been born.
Yeah.
And that sums it up. Van Gogh is the most famous painter in the world now, but he was completely unknown in his time except by a few people that bought his paintings through his brother Theo.
Who was very important.
He was very important, and he kept that, he kept his paintings alive after Van Gogh died. And then, of course, we had this huge renaissance over the last 100 years. So I don't think it's a completely realized great film. I felt like I was getting maybe just part of the story, maybe not the complete biopic. But on the other hand, Doug, we've talked on this show, sometimes biopics that cover too long a life of an artist or a painter or a musician or whoever, they fail because you have old age makeup that doesn't work. Some scenes have to be strung together. Things move too rapidly. This focuses on his later life painting in the south of France and then his time at the insane asylum and then his death, which is still kind of disputed by Schnabel whether he did kill himself. There were some boys kind of torturing him. There was a gun. I'll leave it to the audience to try to investigate that as well.
There was a lot of booze in his life too.
Yes, So I think by focusing on one thing, a later part of his life, it works. However, if you want a companion piece to watch Lust for Life, Kirk Douglas is phenomenal in the part. That covers more of his whole life, and it talks about his attempts to become a priest, which failed. And that is touched on in this film as well. But Defoe is phenomenal. I want to also single out Oscar Isaac as Gauguin. He really brings that arrogance that Gauguin had that Anthony Quinn successfully turned into an Oscar win for supporting actor in Lust for Life. Isaac's very good in the part. We have some other big names like Mathieu Amalric, who's featured in several of Schnabel's films as well. So not a long film. Understand you're probably watching an experimental, almost student-like film.
Well, he was one of the great masters of Impressionism.
Yes.
And so does the film sort of give you a sense of how that came to be on a canvas?
Yeah, so they do have discussions of the Impressionists, he and Gauguin do, and how they're trying to move away from that. And they actually derogatorily talk about Monet being past his prime and Degas and these kind of things. So they were really trying to forge their own style of painting. Post-Impressionist is usually where Van Gogh gets stuck in because he's younger than the rest of that crowd.
Well, there were Fauvists at that time too, and mm-hmm. he sort of falls into that category.
Yeah, but what I get from the film is Van Gogh was his own painter.
Yeah.
He doesn't really fall into any category. His paintings are unlike anything I've ever seen in my life. And there's a quality to them when he paints people that are poor, people in bars, the downtrodden of life. Nobody painted the downtrodden of life better than Van Gogh did. And his self-portraits, the sunlight. He talks about nature being his friend. There's nothing better than being in nature. And so that's really what expresses through him. Defoe's not going to win the Oscar, but a well-deserved nomination, his fourth career nomination, and I urge people to go see this.
Well, if they ever get a chance to go to an exhibit of Van Gogh's work, because seeing it in person is remarkable in its own right. It, certainly his images are out there. Everybody's seen Starry Night and that
yes.
kind of thing. They're very evocative design images, very strong paintings. But the paintings themselves, wow, they mm-hmm. are something to see.
And like I said, now we have two great performances of him on screen that people can compare this and then go back and watch Kirk Douglas in Lust for Life.
I'm also thinking about he's Dutch and he's from a tradition. I mean, there's so many great Dutch artists. Rembrandt, to mention just mm-hmm. one very prominent name. So he was in a tradition, in an art tradition that was probably not too friendly to him at the time.
And you know, I think Schnabel's filmmaking style fits Van Gogh's life because Schnabel is not a traditional director. If you saw Diving Bell and the Butterfly or Basquiat, these are not traditional storytelling type films. They're very, you know, it feels like you're watching an experimental film with kind of herky-jerky editing and handheld camera techniques and things like that. And I think that technique fits with Van Gogh's tortured life, his inability to fit in with people, and really kind of that nervousness that he carried around with him at all times.
Well, the Oscar trivia sort of is obvious, but I think our listeners would want to know this because if Willem Dafoe does get this fourth nomination, he will exceed the number of nominations that Kirk Douglas got.
He did get his fourth nomination.
Okay, so that's
yes.
– so Kirk Douglas
Kirk,
got
Kirk
three.
Kirk had three, right.
Four.
Champion, 1949, The Bad and the Beautiful in 52, and Lust for Life in 56.
And he actually won.
He did get the honorary Oscar in 1995.
Yeah, and now Kirk Douglas is how old?
102.
Wow.
I don't know if he's going to see this movie or not, but
well, I hope he does because I think he'd appreciate it.
I think actually. He would too.
All right. Yes. We've been to the movies with Matt Olien.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Basin Electric Power Cooperative of Bismarck, serving 3 million consumers in 9 states with electricity from wind, natural gas, coal, hydro, and nuclear.
This is Dakota Datebook for February 8th. When the Dakota Territories first made laws in 1865, they based them on the New York Penal Code, which dictated that murder was always punishable by hanging. In 1883, the option of life in prison was added. Subsequently, imposition of the death penalty began to fall off, as North Dakota juries were reluctant to make such final decisions. Many immigrants from totalitarian regimes distrusted capital punishment. In 1915, citizens petitioned against execution, and later that year, the state struck it down except for treason or when murder was committed by an inmate already sentenced to life. That latter provision was removed in 1973. The first attempt to reinstate the death penalty came in 1926. People had begun to wonder if capital punishment actually had been a deterrent for hard criminals. From the beginning of 1926 to the end of 1927, the Bismarck Tribune published 37 articles favoring capital punishment. Attorney General George Schaefer did believe it served as a deterrent, and he thought life sentences were too soft. Soon, the Legislative Committee of the North Dakota Association of State Attorneys voiced support for the death penalty. In early January, there was a bill in the legislature. Many of the arguments in the Senate reflected modern debates over capital punishment, deterrent versus legalized murder. However, one discussion left out of most modern debates is whether it should apply to women as well as men. Some legislators felt the laws tended to be too lenient towards women, which encouraged them to kill their spouses in domestic disputes. However, one legislator felt the death penalty should apply only to men, even if this was the case, because in his words, if a woman kills a man, the chances are he should have been killed long ago anyway. Ultimately, the death penalty was not reinstated. After the Senate voted it down 30-19, the House followed suit, about this time in February of 1927. Since then, there have been two more attempts to reinstate capital punishment, but there seems to be little chance of it returning. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Lucid Thomas. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
It's been almost a year since 17 people were killed in a shooting at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida. We'll speak with two Parkland students about their efforts to end gun violence. Also, Virginia's three top politicians caught up in race and sex scandals will have the latest. And how do dictators decide it's time to go? Saturday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
7 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Before we wrap up Main Street for today and the week, it's the last day you can get in on our short and sweet offer for our membership drive. Contribute $10 a month and we'll send cocoa truffles out anywhere in the continental U.S. in time for Valentine's Day. It's next week, after all. You can do that by giving us a call toll-free at 800-359-4145 or going online to prairiepublic.org and clicking on Donate. Monday on Main Street, Indigenous people may see museums as places where their cultural objects are interpreted by voices not their own. Well, there's an effort to help Native Americans pursue careers in museums. And on Monday, we'll discuss a new fellowship program with Joe Horsecapture, Director of Native American Initiatives for the Minnesota Historical Society. And Ron Smith will offer some horticultural ideas for Valentine's Day. And we hope you'll check out Main Street Weekend, Sunday morning at 10 Central. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.